Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got the usual two segments up for tonight. First, we'll have a little exchange about immigration and immigration policy. Joining us in the studio will be Michelle Wooker, author of the book Lockout, right? And David Bacon will join us on the phone, author of the book Illegal People, and they will discuss their different perspectives on immigration. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Sarah Roy, who's an economist affiliated with the Middle Eastern Institute at Harvard, expert on the economy and social structure of Gaza. And we'll talk to her about what Gaza was like going into this horrendous war and what is going on now in Gaza and what the media may or may not be telling us about all that. But before we get to that, some comments on the news. And first, some non-economic news. After the election last November, it was widely reported that the black vote contributed heavily to the passage of the anti-gay marriage measure Proposition 8 in California. The exit poll reported some 70% of black voters supporting the measure. A new paper by my friend Karen Sherrill of Hunter College, who's been on this show several times, and Patrick Egan of NYU says that this is largely wrong. First of all, the exit poll greatly overstated black support for Prop 8. Their analysis of other polls and precinct-level voting patterns suggests that the true level of support was around 58% versus 48% for whites. And the major reason for that 10-point gap is that black voters as a whole are much more religious than whites, and religion is one of the principal keys to support for the measure. For example, among those going to church once a week or more, 70% voted yes. Those going hardly ever, 30%. Once you control for the level of religiosity, there was no difference between black and white support for Prop 8. That is, religious blacks were no more likely to vote for it than religious whites. Other keys to support: age and ideology. The older a voter was, the more likely he or she was to vote yes. And the more conservative, the more likely. Looking ahead, Egan and Sherrill found that gay marriage will almost certainly win these sorts of votes sometime in the not-too-distant future. For example, 61% of Californians voted against same-sex marriage in 2000 in a similar ballot measure. Last November, 52% did, a decline of 9 points. Egan and Sherrill also find that people born between 1940 and 1960 were more likely to vote for same-sex marriage in 2008 than in 2000. That within-cohort shift, to use the demographer's language, when combined with the fact that younger voters are far more likely to support marriage equality than older ones, means that the historical tide is moving strongly in the direction of same-sex marriage. And now to the economic news, which is a lot less cheering. Let's start with a longer-term view. Just how long is this misery likely to go on? Judging by the historical record, we're only in the early stages of this downturn. In a new paper, economists Carmen Reinhart of the University of Maryland and Ken Rogoff of Harvard have taken the measure of several major banking crises over the last few decades, actually more like 18 banking crises over the last few decades, to give us some hint of what lies ahead of us. Not to spoil the dramatic tension, but the road ahead looks pretty rough. Their conclusions, reduced to the audio equivalent of bullet points, are: declines in asset prices are deep and prolonged, an average of 35% for house prices over the course of 6 years, and 55% declines over 3.5 years for stocks. Declines in GDP and employment are, as they say, profound. The unemployment rate rises an average of 7 points over the 4 years after a financial crisis, and per capita GDP declines by 9% over the course of 2 years. And government debt explodes, up an average of 86%, partly because of bailout costs, but also because of recession-induced declines in tax revenues. And where are we in all these, each of these possible roadmaps? House prices are off about 30% in inflation-adjusted terms, according to the national averages, particularly the Case-Shiller White Index. So we're just about 5 points shy of that average. But the decline has been going on for only about 2.5 years, less than half of the crisis average. The decline in our stock market is also about 5 points shy of the average, about 50% decline in stocks compared with 55% for the average of those crises. But again, we're still well short of the average duration of the bear run, about a year rather than over three. On the other measures, we've only begun the slide. For example, we've had only one quarter of decline in per capita GDP, and that was less than half a point, about a 20th of a typical decline. If we're experiencing anything like the crisis average, it will be unlike anything that most grown-ups have lived through. There was an 11% decline in real GDP the year after World War II ended, but aside from that, we've only had declines of 2 to 3% in our worst recession since then. The historical crisis average would be 3 or 4 times that bad. The story is similar with unemployment. We're just 2 years into the rise, half the average duration in Reinhardt and Rogoff's sample, and only about a third of the way along the percentage point increase. The low on the unemployment rate in the recent cycle was 4.5%. We're now approaching 7%. If we see the typical 7-point increase, then the jobless rate should top out at around 11.5%, breaking the post-depression record of just under 11 set in 1982. The last time it was above 11 was in 1941, just before World War II decisively ended the Great Depression. And we've only begun the massive government borrowing that the crisis will require. The other day, Republican House Leader John Boehner, the unpurged adolescent in me, has a hard time not deliberately mispronouncing his name with a long O, followed by a Beavis-like cackle. But Boehner said the other day that we can't borrow and spend our way out of this mess. But in fact, that's the only way we can get out of it. I have no idea what he's talking about. But more on all that in a moment. Reinhardt and Rogoff ask how relevant the historical precedents are for the defining the future of our economic fate. Mitigating the worst prospects are the aggressive policy responses in the U.S. and elsewhere, which were not present in many other cases that they studied. Although, also in many of those other cases, the crises were national or regional, not global, and global makes them mutually reinforcing. And Reinhardt and Rogoff also warn that we should never flatter ourselves into thinking that we are smarter than our predecessors. As I say, a few years back, many people would have said that improvements in financial engineering had done much to tame the business cycle and limit the risk of financial contagion. That's the end of the quote from them, and we know how all that turned out. And speaking of the policy response, I have to admit that I'm a little surprised by how quickly Barack Obama caved in to Republican preferences on his stimulus program. Regular listeners know that I've been quite a skeptic about the candidate of changiness all along, but I thought he was, despite his many other shortcomings, pretty solid on the economic package. His advisor, Larry Summers, a man with many faults, had nonetheless been saying the right things in recent months on the importance of infrastructure spending and of subsidies to clean energy development and other green jobs programs, long-term measures with a perspective well beyond the immediate economic cycle. So far, so good. But then we learned earlier in the week that, in order to appease congressional Republicans, Obama would give over about 40% of the stimulus program, some $300 billion of the total of $775, a number that, by the way, may have to get bigger over time. He'll give over 40% of that to tax cuts. And not just the tax cuts promised for the middle class, that Obama promised during the campaign for the middle class, but tax breaks for business. This is bad economics and weird politics. Tax cuts are much less stimulative than government spending. People may save the tax cuts or use them to pay down debt or spend them on imports. Infrastructure investments are spent here and don't leak away. They generate a lot more additional economic activity, demand for bulldozers, concrete, solar panels, you name it. Over the longer term, we need to consume less and invest more, and the people who need to consume less are our rich. They shouldn't be pampered with tax cuts. And investment tax credits, which Obama is also reportedly considering, are a total waste of money. Businesses invest when they think they're going to make money and when they've got the cash to fund the investments or can borrow it. Now, prospects for future profits are dim, cash flow is shrinking, and it's hard to get a loan. Investment tax credits stimulate no investment. They're just a gift to businesses for money they would have spent anyway. Aside from these economic points, what is the political point of these compromises? The Dems won big, and the Republicans lost. The GOP has been reduced to representing a provincial petty bourgeoisie confined largely to the South and Mountain West. Obama supposedly wants 80 Senate votes for his bill. Why? Why start out with a compromise instead of cutting deals as the process unfolds? Why not take advantage of your position of strength? The only thing I can think of that makes any sense is Adolf Reed's speculation that the Democrats would like to peel off some of the saner Republicans and become a totally centrist party. That would leave the Republicans as a kind of rump formation of authoritarian fundamentalists with a fondness for secretly dressing in bedsheets. The left of the Democratic Party would presumably have nowhere else to go or deceive themselves into thinking that all the changiness was about to break their way. Fat chance. Obama looks less like a Roosevelt, Franklin, or Teddy with each passing day.
And now an update just for the KPFA and podcast audiences. Friday morning brought the release of the December employment report, and it was a horror. Total employment fell by 524,000, with almost every sector showing losses. Almost half the loss came in goods production, mainly construction and manufacturing. But even within those two sectors, losses were widespread. Within construction, it's no longer just a housing story. Non-residential was down hard as well. And within manufacturing, it's not just motor vehicles, it's nearly everything. But it wasn't just the goods sector either. Private services got hammered, off 280,000. Temp employment, which tends to lead broader trends, was down hard. So was retail, another sector with some leading properties. About the only positive was in healthcare, which is good news if you work in that sector, but a mixed blessing for the rest of us coping with rising medical bills. Government added just 7,000, but I expect it's going to join the losing sectors as budget constraints begin to bite. Total private employment in both goods and services was off almost 2.5% for the year ending in December, the worst reading since 1982. Private services were off 1.5% for the year, the worst reading since 1958, which was the sector's all-time worst year since modern stats began in 1939. Private services losses in the deep recessions of the mid-1970s and early 1980s were under 0.5%, a fraction of today's losses. In other words, sectors that in the past were nearly immune to recession are now joining in the slump. Downturns used to be mainly about manufacturing and construction. Now everyone's falling down. Those numbers all came from the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of employers. They also do a monthly survey of households, and the news from that side was just as bad. The unemployment rate rose a very sharp 0.4 point to 7.2%, the highest we've seen since 1992. The Bureau's broadest measure of unemployment, which includes people who've given up the job search as hopeless, as well as those only working part-time because they can't find full-time work, the so-called U6 rate, rose almost a full point to 13.5%, the highest since that series began in 1994. Over the last year, the number of people working only part-time, who'd prefer full-time work but can't find it, is up almost 75%, a record by a wide margin in more than 30 years of data. The share of the adult population working, the so-called employment population ratio, fell a very sharp 0.4 point to 61%, taking us back to 1986 levels. In other words, as of a few months ago, we'd undone the major employment expansion of the 1990s. Now, we've undone most of the 1980s as well. As bad as the December figures were, it's likely that we face at least several more months of the same. A very large fiscal stimulus is more urgently needed now than ever.
Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes to talk about immigration.
Does anyone really need a $1 billion rocket? Does anyone need a $60,000 car? Does anyone need another president? Or the sins of Swaggart Park 6, 7, 8, 9? Does anyone need yet another politician caught with his pants down and money sticking in his hole? Does anyone need another racist preacher spitting in the wind and only do your harm? Woo! Star man, gone straight to the devil.
And that's some of Lou Reed's Straw Man from 1989, his album New York. All right, we're now joined on the line by David Bacon, the labor journalist and author of the book Illegal People, which came out, I think, last September from Beacon, and in the studio by Michelle Walker, who wrote a book called Lockout about immigration policy, and she's also the executive director of the World Policy Institute here in New York City. Welcome to both of you.
It's great to be back.
You're there, David.
Yep, I am.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's start with you, David. The immigration system is commonly described as broken. That's the title on Michelle Walker's review of your book in on Foreign Policy and Focus. I don't know if she chose that title, but it is a common description. Is this system broken, or is it really working pretty much as intended, do you think?
Well, I think it works for those people who take advantage of it, but it doesn't work very well for working people, whether they're migrants or whether they're working people here in the U.S. What we have is we have a system that on the one hand produces migration by uprooting and displacing communities in countries like Mexico or in Central America or the Caribbean, in fact, actually in developing countries all over the world, using free trade agreements, structural adjustment policies, the kind of neoliberal changes that make life more and more impossible for people in poor communities and farming communities or workers. And then those people who become migrants as a result of that, coming to the United States, find that they are both part of a system which uses and exploits their labor, but also criminalizes them and basically treats them as second-class people.
But it's a system that works rather well for employers, isn't it?
That's right, exactly, because it's a really being used, our immigration system is being used by employers as a labor supply system, and the proposals that we've seen in Congress in the last few years are ones that would kind of write that into stone. You know, right now we have kind of a debate in the U.S. over what the purpose of our immigration system should be. You know, we had a system that was a very overt labor supply system from 1942 to 1964, the Bracero program. In 64, the Chicano Civil Rights Movement convinced Congress to abolish that program. And in 65, we got an immigration law that said essentially that the purpose of migration should be to reunite families and to create strong and healthy communities here in the U.S. Now what we are seeing are proposals that essentially would move us backwards, that would say, yes, we need people in the U.S. economy, but people should come here as workers. They should come here to work, and that's all that their value to the system is.
All right. Thank you, David. And Michelle Walker, do you have any reactions to what you just heard?
Well, yeah, I also think that the system is deeply, deeply broken, that it hurts a lot of people. It hurts American workers. It hurts immigrants, certainly. But I disagree that it blanket helps all employers. I think there are a bunch of different kinds of employers out there with very, very different interests. There are the employers who make their money by driving labor costs as far down as they can, and that's the only way that they can make profits. There are other businesses that need a steady supply of workers that see productivity rising if, for example, you can teach more immigrant workers English, if you know that you've got a stable workforce that you can invest in. There are also the kinds of employers whose businesses provide services and goods and who are counting on a rapidly growing immigrant market. Hispanic purchasing power is as seen at about $1 trillion, Asian American at about half that much. And those employers have a huge stake in not the kind of temporary guest worker, marginalized population that some other employers do. They have an interest in seeing people reach for the American dream. They have an interest in a stable workforce that they can invest in that would allow them to, for example, upgrade some of their technologies, increase productivity. So I think you've got two very, very different groups there, and some employers have a huge interest in legalization, in bringing in workers who have a path to citizenship and who have more rights. And that's the kind of thing that actually benefits all workers. And that's something I think that David and I certainly agree on, that a better legal status would benefit immigrants and U.S. workers.
Well, I think a lot of people would ask, as the unemployment rate heads towards 7%, why do we need imported workers to do this work? Aren't there Americans who could do it?
Well, I think that people tend to put it in a complete zero-sum game. I think, first of all, with the economy, we've got, ironically, a bit of an opening in immigration policy because you're starting to see the numbers of immigrants coming go down. You're seeing a lot of reports of people going back home. It's not a case of you've got these jobs that you've either got immigrants or Americans doing. There are areas of the economy where there aren't quite enough American workers to do those jobs, and you need immigrant workers to fill that gap. A big part of that is actually good news, that an increasing percentage of Americans are finishing high school. And so there are fewer Americans who are out for the sort of lower-skilled jobs that some, certainly not all of the migrants do, because they're also high-skilled immigrants. So they're filling jobs that there aren't enough Americans to do.
David Bacon, where do you stand on this question of whether immigrants are displacing native foreign workers? Do they, or is that even not a proper question to ask?
Well, I think this is capitalism. That means that we have competition. We have competition in the labor market, and this is something that employers like and they desire. In fact, it's built structurally into the system. You know, our problem isn't really whether we have good employers or bad employers. Our problem is how the system works, and we have to fix how the system works rather than simply rely on good employers to do the right thing. So in terms of looking at what that fix might be, I think there are really two parts of it. On the one hand, we need to stop using trade policy and U.S. economic policy abroad as a means of displacing workers. Now, that's not the way it's put publicly. Publicly it's put in terms of increasing investment opportunities and creating a favorable climate for investment abroad. But the very same things that create a favorable investment climate in countries like Mexico are those things that actually make life very difficult for working people and produce displacement and migration. So we have to kind of stop that. And I think actually we are a rich country. We could do things in Mexico and in other countries that would actually help to increase people's quality of life and make migration into much more of a choice rather than something that people have to do to survive. But here in the U.S., we need a policy that looks at migration basically as a human process, that rather than seeing it simply as a way of supplying workers to industry at a price it wants to pay, that we emphasize the goals of family unification, of strengthening communities, of helping people to develop their culture, and ensuring that we have a society in which everybody has equality in terms of their rights and in terms of their social status. You know, part of the problem with guest worker programs and these labor recruitment programs is that the people who are recruited are not equal to the people who are living in the communities around them. You know, people's ability to stay in the country is tied to their job. You know, you lose your job, you have to leave. People have to kind of work in a condition of servitude just in order to be able to get eventually to that green card that Michelle is talking about and eventually to get to citizenship. And a lot of the guest worker programs don't even allow you to get to green cards and citizenship. You sort of spend all of your working life in these programs. So we need instead to emphasize things that increase the equality of people in the workforce. And if employers need workers, they can do what employers have always had to do to attract workers, which is offer wages and conditions that workers are willing to accept. You know, it should not be the basis of U.S. immigration policy to supply labor to employers. You know, if employers need more farm workers, why don't they raise the wages out in the fields?
They sure don't like to do that, though.
No.
That's the voice of David Bacon, the labor journalist and author of the book Illegal People, came out several months ago from Beacon. And in the studio here is Michelle Walker, who is the director of the World Policy Institute and author of the book Lockout, which came out several years ago, right?
2006,
yes. And you were on the show when that came out, as I recall. Well, first of all, I have two questions for you. One, Michelle Walker. One is, do you think that trade agreements really contribute that much to immigration flows? Does the free movement of capital result in the free movement of extremely disadvantaged labor as well?
Well, I think this is a kind of case where you really need to look at some of the details, particularly NAFTA and Mexican immigration, which is, of course, the really the thing that people are talking about. The agricultural part of that trade policy, it has been an absolute disaster. We're real hypocrites on that in the United States. We say it's okay for us to pay billions and billions of dollars of subsidies to huge agribusiness and send those subsidized goods to other countries, but then other countries can't subsidize small farmers. They can't keep those goods out. We've done it in trade agreement after trade agreement. In the Dominican Republic, I was particularly upset to see that we insisted that high fructose corn syrup be part of the DR-CAFTA trade agreement because that market was created by us first making a lot of money off of third world sugar markets, and then when the markets crashed, putting up barriers that then destroyed those markets and created this artificial corn sweetener market, which tastes terrible. If you've had Coke in a country with real sugar, you'll see what I mean. So our agricultural policy is really at the heart of the problems with our trade policy in other countries, particularly Mexico.
And second question, what do you think of guest worker programs? David obviously doesn't like them very much. Do you think this is a possible compromise formation?
No, I dislike them quite a bit. I think that there are definitely some cases where workers may come for seasonal work. I also, like David, have a very big problem with the prohibition on people switching those visas to permanent visas. I really disagreed with the fact that the majority of the past proposals for reforms relied mainly on guest worker programs. I think that was a huge mistake. We need to be looking at permanent visas. We need to be looking at path to citizenship. If we are in those cases where people are really interested in seasonal work, if we're going to do that, we shouldn't tie that visa to the employer. We should allow people to move from one employer to the other so that they're not really, you know, beholden. So I absolutely agree that guest worker emphasis is a huge problem, and I think a lot of businesses would agree with that, too. They would also like to see the legalization as the preferred option.
I thought the two of you would disagree more than this. We're losing the drama.
Sorry.
David Bacon, it seems to me over the last couple of years, we've seen an increase in immigration raids that are really just union-busting activities. Could you talk some about that?
Well, sure. This has been going on for quite some time. In fact, since 1986, really, because the Immigration Reform and Control Act in 1986 made it for the first time a crime for an employer to hire somebody who didn't have any papers. What in effect that really meant was that if you were an undocumented person, and remember there are about 12 million people in the United States who don't have papers, that essentially it becomes a crime for you to work. Now, people have often said that up until the Bush administration, employer sanctions were never really enforced. That's not really true, though. What they really mean by that is employers weren't fined and they didn't go to jail. But thousands and thousands of workers were fired from their jobs in various different immigration enforcement schemes under Clinton and even under Papa Bush right after the act was passed. You know, we could point to Operation Vanguard in Nebraska, where they went through the entire meatpacking industry of the state of Nebraska and wound up forcing about 3,000 workers out of their jobs as a result of that. But what Bush did when he was elected is he began, especially after 2001, using federal criminal penalties against migrants, not just simply firings and deportations, so that, for instance, in the immigration raid at the agriprocessors plant in Postville, Iowa, the workers who were picked up there were charged with a federal crime of misusing a Social Security number and sent to federal prison for 5 months. That really has upped the ante, and the reason why the administration is doing this is, on the one hand, this has become kind of a vehicle for employers to use when they face union organizing drives or when workers want to enforce labor standards. So all of a sudden, employers will pull what's called the no-match letter, or some say that they have suddenly found reason to doubt the immigration status of their own workers and use that as a pretext for firing people. And that's happened time after time after time. But Michael Chertoff has said that the purpose of the raids is also to do what he calls close the back door and open the front door. And by what he means is force workers who are coming to the United States who are undocumented to only come as participants in contract labor programs and at the same time pressure Congress and pressure the public to pass the kind of immigration program that the Bush administration had in those bills that failed in Congress in the last few years that were, as Michelle says, overwhelmingly guest worker programs. I think that's the big choice, in fact, right now in front of the Obama administration, is not just whether or not to reduce the rates. I have faith in Obama and some of the people that he's bringing into office, that they're going to kind of see that that the cost of these raids and the cost of this kind of enforcement is really horrendous in terms of the suffering that it's imposing on people. The big question, though, is whether or not we should move in the direction that these raids have been trying to push us, which is towards a system in which we allow employers to essentially recruit labor abroad and bring it here in a very, very vulnerable status, and then say to people, the only way you can come to the United States is as a participant in those programs.
All right. We've only got a minute left, so I want to ask this question. You each have 30 seconds to answer it. It's a big one, though. Is there any principled reason why the border should be closed at all, why people should not be free to move as they want? I mean, is the border just exist to protect our privilege, and is there any principal reason to defend it, Michelle?
Well, the border protection should be aimed at drug smugglers, and we should also be taking aim at human smugglers, not at the people who are victims of the human smugglers. And I think Americans are concerned about our border. They want territorial integrity, but we shouldn't be worried about, you know, the poor people crossing the desert just to work. That's not what we need to protect ourselves from.
And David?
Well, I think we need human rights in border communities. So I think that migration should be something that's voluntary and not forced on people, and that if those things are respected, that there's no reason why we can't make the border between the U.S. and Mexico look in effect like the border between the U.S. and Canada.
Well, thanks to both of you. That last voice was that of David Bacon, who is a prominent labor journalist and author of the book Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants, published last September by Beacon. And also in the studio with us was Michelle Walker, who is the director of the World Policy Institute and author of the book Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity, if we have such a thing, depends on getting it right, which came out a couple of years ago for Public Affairs. Thanks to both of you, and let's take a break, and we will be back.
Thanks, Doug.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about Gaza. Some of the Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima by the Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki, composed in 1960, performed by the Polish Radio National Symphony Orchestra under the composer's direction. We are now joined by Sarah Roy, who is a research associate at Harvard's Middle Eastern Center and an economist who has spent a lot of time studying Gaza. Welcome to Behind the News, Sarah Roy.
Thank you very much.
And you said you wanted to start with a little statement, so please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Doug. Yes, I'd like to say a couple things. One is that first, in nearly 25 years of living and working and researching in Gaza, I have never encountered such atrocity and barbarity as I see today. I have never had to confront the image of burned and dismembered children. And no matter where on the political spectrum one stands, nothing, absolutely nothing, can possibly justify the massacre of innocent men, women, and children, and that is what is happening in Gaza today. I am a scholar, and I use language very carefully, but this is really nothing less than a slaughter of defenseless human beings, and it is absolutely monstrous. I also want to make a couple comments very briefly about the gross distortions of the Gaza war in presented in the U.S. media. The ravaging of Gaza is not only about weakening Hamas, has been argued. In fact, I think Hamas rockets have very little, if anything, to do with Israel's war. This is an attack, and it should be understood as an attack against the Palestinian people and their resistance, whether it be by Hamas or by the people of Gaza, and their constant refusal to accede to Israeli demands and conditions and accept defeat. This has been a characteristic feature of Israel's relationship with Gaza since 1967, because resistance in the Gaza Strip to Israeli control has always been strongest and most tenacious there. And this is critically important to understand. And simply put, Israel cannot really tolerate any territory that it cannot ultimately and fully control. And that is why it has always refused to engage Palestinians as equals. And this points to the logic of the occupation, and this is my last point. The war in Gaza is not a discrete event without history or context, despite the fact that it has been consistently presented that way in the American media. This war did not emerge in a vacuum, but is part of a logical and ongoing and prolonged context of Israeli military occupation that has all been but forgotten. In fact, I've rarely heard the word occupation mentioned in any of the presentations I've heard. So occupation must be understood as a repressive and brutal system of control that has only grown more powerful and more damaging in the last 15 years, especially since the so-called peace process began. So what we're seeing in Gaza today should be understood as the tragic but inevitable outcome of an increasingly repressive occupation. And that's what I want to start off saying.
All right. Well, thank you. And it does take it takes words away sometimes watching this stuff on TV or seeing pictures of it, so it's hard to proceed. But, you know, there are people who say the timing of this war was because Bush is about to leave office and Israel feels it can get a blank check. It's going to have a more difficult time with the new administration coming in. There are people who say it's just timed because of the rocket attacks. Well, what's your theory of why the war was launched when it was?
The ceasefire, it's recently come out from Israeli sources that this war had actually been planned about a year ago. It had been planned, they were talking about attacking and invading Gaza in January of 2008. And this points to what I started out saying, that the attack against Gaza is fundamentally one against resistance to Israeli control. And the ceasefire of last June was enacted because there was heightened violence between Hamas and Israel. And Israel, took it as a, the following month, following the ceasefire, were actually very quiet, despite periodic violations by both sides. But it was a period of quiet, and in fact, there's a recent report that was just published by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs acknowledging that, saying it was working and working very well. And the question then becomes, what happened? Why did it break? Well, really, the truce was broken on November 4th by Israel. And this is a fact that has been completely buried in the media.
You read that in the British press, but you don't read that in the American
papers. Yeah, in the American papers. Yeah. And why was it broken? I mean, what happened was, on that day, on November 4th, Israel claimed that the Palestinians, that the Hamas was building a tunnel under the security border, and that they had been planning to abduct some Israeli soldiers. Now, I can't obviously say that that's untrue, but it seems debatable whether Hamas would have risked a successful truce or a truce that was working and the possibility of political progress to abduct Israeli soldiers. So the question becomes, why, if in fact Israel did intend to break the truce, why would it have done it? And my analysis of the situation, and Professor Norton and I, Richard Norton and I wrote a piece about this recently, maintains that during the period of what the Israelis refer to as the lull, the period of quiet, there was increasing talk within the international community about restarting political negotiations and restarting some kind of political progress because there was quiet and things and the conditions seemed to be getting better. There was increasing talk, particularly within the European theater, within the EU, of freezing Israeli settlements or pursuing policies that would pressure Israel or exert more pressure on Israel to freeze the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. There was a strengthening movement to boycott Israeli settlement products. There was also increasing talk about engaging Hamas, whether it be directly or indirectly, but somehow bringing them into a political process of negotiations. And also, there were very clear efforts on the part of the Egyptian government to mediate the very divisive internal disputes between Hamas and Fatah and try to reinstate some sort of unified form of government, a Hamas-Fatah government, unified government that had existed a year before. So all these, you know, all these factors increasingly pointed to a process or reinstating a political process of negotiations, which is what successive Israeli governments have rejected consistently, because negotiations would, of course, ultimately lead to a place where they would have to compromise and meaningfully talk about a two-state solution, which is something they have been unwilling to do consistently. And so we theorize, and we're not alone in this, certainly other people have come up with the same analysis, is that the process was moving forward and it was working, and that is precisely why it had to be undermined.
That's the voice of Sarah Roy, who's a research associate at the Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies. Let's go back a little bit. Before mm-hmm. this war started, life in Gaza was really pretty rough. Give us an outline of what economic and social life in Gaza was like in the months leading up to the war.
Well, that's a question that would be an entire lecture unto itself. But if we go back, let's say since the Oslo process that began in 1993, where people believe that there was a process moving forward where leading towards a two-state solution that would, on the Palestinian side, be composed of Gaza, the West Bank, and part of, in East Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera. There was a sense that this was working. There was a sense that economic prosperity was increasing and so on and so forth. But we now know, we knew at the time, those of us who studied it, and we certainly now know from the literature that was not the case. And it was during Oslo that a lot of the most pernicious measures that we see today were actually introduced, and some of them included the division and isolation of the West Bank and Gaza. And this was actually a primary objective of the Oslo process on Israel and the United States' part, because if you divide the two territories and you isolate them from each other, you weaken not only the political movement, you weaken their economic interaction, you dissect and diminish the sense of political community and sense of a national entity, because they literally prevented people and goods from moving between these two territories that were natural markets for each other historically. So, and it was very effective. So Gaza was basically isolated and cut off, not only from the West Bank, but from Israel as well. And this, of course, had a dramatic impact on its economy. Closure policy was introduced, not during Oslo, but just prior, but it became institutionalized during this time, which basically restricted and at times totally prevented the movement of people and goods, not only from Gaza to the West Bank and Israel, but in the West Bank, also within the West Bank itself. And, in all this discussion of Gaza, we have forgotten the West Bank, and conditions there are also quite extreme and acute. So you had
what has the wall contributed to life in both these places?
The wall, you said?
Yeah.
Well, certainly in the West Bank, it has introduced a great deal of damage economically because it further constrains the movement of people and limits the movement of people. It has been built on large swaths of Palestinian land, some of it viable agricultural land. And what's happened in the West Bank in the last 15 years is really the total cantonization of Palestinian lands, that is, cutting up the West Bank into disconnected, territorially disconnected cantons. And so today you have anywhere between 10 and 15, I believe the last number was, cantons and subcantons. And people live in these isolated territorial entities that are disconnected from each other. And this has had an enormously damaging impact, not only on the economy, which was weak to begin with and severely compromised after many years of the Oslo process, but now you take an already small and weak economy and you further dissect it and divide it into these disconnected economic enclaves. It has also had, of course, a dramatic and very damaging effect on social relations and social structure, which is less visible from the outside. But if you spend any kind of time in this area, you understand how this has affected the ability of people to think and function as a community. They've been very atomized, they've been very isolated from each other, and their ability to think beyond, you know, their neighborhood, their locality has been severely diminished because the practical reality is they can't move very easily from point A to point B. You know, the difference really during Oslo, and this was a fact, you know, I would say, certainly by 1998, the total division and isolation of Gaza and the West Bank was pretty much complete. And the internal cantonization of the West Bank, and what I mean by that is, you know, the not only cutting the West Bank into these disconnected cantons, but also preventing people within those little areas from going from point A to point B. So, you know, the distance between Ramallah, which is a main city in the West Bank, and Jerusalem, I believe, is probably about 15 miles, but it might as well be 15,000 miles because it is without the requisite permits and whatnot. People can't go. They can't literally go into Jerusalem, and this has also been a function of a process of de-Arabizing Jerusalem and Judaizing Jerusalem and pushing the Palestinian community out towards the West Bank and keeping them out of Jerusalem. So, you know, I have friends in Ramallah who haven't been to Jerusalem in 10 or 12 years, yet you could walk from Ramallah to Jerusalem if you wanted to, and let alone people who live in the northern West Bank and want to go, you know, someone who lives, for example, in Jenin and wants to go to Hebron in the south, which in the, you know, in previous times, it was, probably a 40-minute car drive. Today, it's virtually impossible. And I have friends there who tell me that, you know, their parents don't want them to marry people from the north if they live in the south and vice versa because they're afraid if their children marry somebody from Hebron, marry somebody from Jenin, and their daughters leave to go live with their husband and their husband's families, they'll never see them again. I have a friend in Ramallah who's married to a West Banker. She's from Gaza. She hasn't seen her parents in about 15 years, and she has two children since she got married and moved away. She's had two children who her parents have never seen. And the stories go on and on and on. So all of this precedes, you know, has preceded clearly what's going on today, but it's also, like I said, it's a logical and tragic but inevitable outcome of Israeli occupation and a system of control that is by design there to limit Palestinians and reduce the amount of area in which they live and to aggrandize to the Jewish state as much land as it can. And this is, you know, this is the the harsh truth, and it has always been the harsh truth, that the various policies embarked upon by the State of Israel, the Oslo process, all of that was never about peace. It wasn't even about security. What this is about fundamentally is about establishing, creating, and maintaining an exclusivist Jewish state no matter the cost. And that's why this is the reason fundamentally for what we see in Gaza today.
Now, people sometimes say that Israel is only hurting itself in the long run by doing these things. Do you buy that kind of argument?
Absolutely. I mean, as a Jew and as somebody who has family and many friends in Israel, absolutely. I mean, the occupation is a corrosive process. And, of course, the people who suffer the most from it, who incur the most damage, are the Palestinians. But it also has a morally corrosive effect on Israelis. And you know, of course, there are many Israelis who have stood up and spoken out against occupation for years and years and years. They've been marginalized within that society, but they're there. And, you know, they have fought to the best of their abilities against this. But this is, you know, this is a process that is, you know, damaging to both sides, one disproportionately so, but ultimately, of course, because, you know, if you take a state and that state puts itself into a position where it is continually occupying another people, denying them their rights, denying them their freedom, forcing them into all sorts of discriminatory patterns, and where people are fundamentally living as second and third and fourth class citizens, where they are denied the rights that you freely accord your own population, so on and so forth. This ultimately, of course, will have a very devastating effect. And also, when you have soldiers, Israeli soldiers, going to Gaza, to Lebanon, to the West Bank, maintaining, you know, there are now over 600 physical barriers, checkpoints and other physical barriers obstructing movement throughout the West Bank. These barriers, or many of the checkpoints, are manned by the army. And many of the, you know, the control of this whole area is ultimately Israel's. And this is done by soldiers. These are done by 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And they behave, in many cases, very brutally. Then they go home, and they're expected to behave normally. And this often doesn't happen. I mean, there are many studies within Israel that are quite alarmist and talk about the impact, the brutalization that soldiers undergo and other, you know, other people involved with the occupation undergo. I mean, brutalization in the sense that they brutalize others and then they come home and this kind of behavior gets expressed towards their own wives, their own children, their own friends, and whatnot. It has ripple effects, and this has been well documented inside Israel. But it's part of the overall system of control.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but is there any way out of this? Is there? Well, there is, of course, could be a way out of it. But is the Israeli political system and the U.S. political system, which enables it, capable of taking the steps necessary to put an end to this horror?
Well, I don't think, you know, first of all, the Israeli government that's going to be elected in February, I think it's highly unlikely that this government whoever leads it, will represent in any way, shape, or form a departure from previous governments. In fact, it will probably be less willing to make the sorts of compromises needed. So there has to be, obviously, there has to be external actors with influence inside Israel that can try to encourage the kind of change or push for the kind of change that will ultimately resolve this. And really, you know, we can look to the U.S. and we can look to the European Union. And both, you know, historically, the U.S., of course, has been an abysmal failure. I just read today in the Financial Times that President-elect Obama has just appointed Dennis Ross as his Middle East envoy, and Mr. Ross was the Middle East envoy during Oslo, and as far as I'm concerned, he was responsible for some of the greatest damage introduced during and by that process. So his appointment, I take as a bitter pill. I think it will potentially be a disaster. I'm certainly hoping to be proven wrong. But the U.S. has a potential role it could play. The question is whether it will play it. It was also announced today in The Guardian that his transition team indicated that they would be willing to hold indirect talks with Hamas officials, and it was regarded as a major breakthrough and as a significant departure from the Bush years. Well, the fact of the matter is that even during the Bush years, particularly since 2004, there were talks between indirect talks and certainly unofficial talks between U.S. officials and Hamas officials. The difference is not in the fact of whether the talks were held or not, but whether they were publicized or not. So, you know, I don't know what that means. It could potentially mean something or not. However, I will say this, that it is absolutely essential to engage Hamas in a political process. You know, whether we like them or not, it's not for us to decide. It's for Palestinians to decide. And they are very much a part of the political landscape. They are a key player. And even though, you know, not all Palestinians support them, they are a part of the political landscape. And they have to be engaged if we are really aiming for a serious resolution of this conflict. And up until now, there has not been a serious commitment on the part of Israel or the United States to meaningfully resolve this conflict along the lines of a viable two-state solution. And until that occurs, this conflict will just burn and burn and burn with disastrous and tragic consequences for all the people in the region.
All right. Well, those are grim words to end on. But thank you for joining us, Sarah Roy. Sarah Roy, who is a researcher at the Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And earlier this week, I think it was Tuesday, the body of Ron Ashton, the guitarist for the Stooges, was found in his house in Ann Arbor. And that's a different kind of sadness, certainly a different register, a different degree. But let's go out with this bit from the Stooges, No Fun, the part where Iggy says, tell him how I feel, Ron. Till next week. Bye.